Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Aramar Tefio on blogtalkradio.com. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience.
Hello, I'm Stuart Alexander, and once again, I would like to welcome our listeners to the Socialist Insight. And today we have Stephen Katz. He is the state chairperson with the Socialist Party USA there in New York. And Stephen, we'd like to welcome you once again to the program.
It's always a pleasure, and I always find it interesting.
Stephen, you always come on. You really add a lot to this program, just like Alan Mackey. He comes on every other week.
Right.
I've been having you on as a frequent guest, and one of the reasons why I have you on, you bring a strong knowledge of socialism, how it works for working people, and also you bring a lot of information where people can understand how capitalism is breaking down in this country and how it has been a failure for thousands of years. But now we see capitalism, the way it operates, we see it more in its advanced stages. And we're going to get into discussing that today. And, Stephen, today our topic is it too late for socialism to save America? And in my opinion, the stage that capitalism is in today, we're going to look at how it was in those same stages in the 1800s with the French, how it was with the British, and also those advanced stages that we have seen over the years, even during the time of World War, just before World War I. But as I mentioned, I just want to welcome you once again to the program.
Thank you.
Stephen, when we look at capitalism and we look at what we talk about on a regular basis about socialism and what it has to offer, and also you're with the Socialist Party USA and I'm with the party as well, but when we look at where capitalism today and what we see in the world with much of is so chaotic. It seemed like it has become the effects of capitalism has become monstrous. And when we talk about many of the benevolent things what socialism has to offer, I just want to start our program today. Is it too late to even make any of those changes possible that we talk about on a regular basis?
Well, it's definitely not too late. I mean, crisis with crisis comes opportunity, and the foremost philosopher and scientist of socialism, which was Karl Marx, predicted this course about 150 years ago. He knew there would be a systemic crisis in the capitalist system, and he knew it would extend to a global crisis. Which is amazing because at the time, capitalism was still confined to just a few countries in Western Europe and the United States, and he was living over there in London, which was the most, Britain was the most advanced capitalist nation at the time. But he could see by analyzing the underlying contradictions and movement in the economy and how the economy of capitalism operates, that eventually it would not be able to sustain itself. And in fact, when we reach a point where it is quite apparent that the system has exhausted itself and there is no way to change it from within, that is precisely the point where socialism has an opening to mobilize masses of people to create a new society. So the answer to that question is, not only is it not too late, but it's right on course.
Well, let's look at some of the things, and I'm going to sort of bounce back and forth because we could see that people were looking at some of the advances that were taking place in Nazi Germany back in the 30s. They were creating jobs. A lot of this was on borrowed money, and now in retrospect, we can see it was on borrowed time. And the resources were abundant. Banks were investing in that country. They were investing billions of dollars to rebuild the economy after World War I. And with all those investments, people thought they were on the right track. They thought they had the leadership necessary to move the country forward. Industry was growing by leaps and bounds at the time. But we can see the same thing that people, before it was able to make a course correction, we can see that a major world war took place where tens of millions of people lost their lives. So saving a country offering with what socialism has to offer, we obviously don't want to follow the same path of and also disillusionment that people had during the time of the 30s, thinking that we're on the right path, and find out that we're on the wrong path, which is leading to war. In our case, we are going from one war to another war to another war, and we can see that this is much of the in the advanced stages of capitalism. That's what imperialism is all about. But are we not going down the same pathway of what Germany followed in the 30s?
Well, one important thing to stress is this is not inevitable. It's not like mixing two chemicals in a test tube and, you know, inevitably 99.999 or whatever the percentage is, you're going to get this almost the same exact result. This, you know, depends on strategy, and it depends on the choices that human beings make in trying to put it into effect. Because a social science operates differently than natural science, and we are the participant observers of our own experiments, so to speak. Now, there was a very strong socialist movement in Germany before the rise of Hitler.
Right.
And if it had been successful, and there was a very decent chance it could have been successful, World War II taken place. There might have been other types of conflicts, but Hitler would not have come to power, and the history of the world might have been very, very different.
Right.
But the socialist movement there, particularly the Communist Party under the direction of the Comintern, which was controlled by Stalin, refused to form a united front with other factors on the left, and did not mobilize in time to stop Hitler's rise. And Hitler, who was a demonic genius of political organization, took from socialism. And after all, his movement was named National Socialism. He took certain things from socialism in terms of trying to provide jobs to people and so on and so on, but in an extreme nationalistic, militaristic, and destructive form, and emotional form as well. So all I'm trying to say is that, yes, when capitalism is in the end stages, which can go on for quite some time, it becomes a very dangerous crisis. It doesn't inevitably have to go in a socialist direction. That depends on the consciousness and the will of the masses of people and the leadership. But it could also move in the direction of a hyper-imperialism. And I would say, and I happen to agree, that, you know, we're at that stage now. Unfortunately, when things are muddling along, people don't see the need for radical change.
Right.
So, in essence, it's kind of it's like facing an it's like if you have a disease where the doctors and the surgeons tell you, look, it's a dangerous operation. You know, you might not survive, but you know, if we don't do it, you're definitely not going to survive. So it's worth taking the risk. It's the same thing in a period like this. Now, we're in a period right now very much similar in many ways to the period before World War One. By that I mean is that we have competing imperialist blocs more and more coming into conflict, and it seems that the tensions between China and the U.S. are ratcheting up more and more, and it seems like the U.S. is helping Japan remilitarize, which, of course, is against the Japanese Constitution, in which at the end of World War II, they did not want that to happen. It was the same thing in Germany. They wanted to keep them, fairly disarmed and only have a minimum military for strict self-defense.
Well,
and,
Stephen, that's just part of the empire building, because the U.S. is the one that's really building that, building the military of Japan. It's not Japan, it's the influence and supposedly to protect U.S. interests. If the U.S. interest wasn't involved, and we know the U.S. interest has everything to do with the capitalists in this country and the super wealthy of the world, if that interest wasn't there, we wouldn't see Japan building up a military at this point.
No, I mean, it's a chess piece in the right part of the chessboard, over there in the Pacific near China, that we have Taiwan in the equation. It's quite possible that tensions will rise to the point where there could be clashes there. The Middle East remains very unstable, and so there is that possibility. But remember, World War One was a massive tragedy for working people all throughout the world. And
War is period.
Yeah, war is hell, and war is a tragedy and extremely destructive. And World
War
One,
their war is in our blood.
Exactly, and of course, the Second International prior to World War One, and this was prior to the Russian Revolution. The general theory in the Second International, and one which was pushed quite a bit by Lenin, was that the international working class could forestall and stop this war by the workers refusing to fight each other, by a farmer in France refusing to fight with a farmer in Germany, by a farmer and a factory worker in Russia refusing to fight with a factory worker in Germany. I mean, it's all that. Now, what happened is when the war did break out, the socialist parties in the Second International, all except for two particular parties, the Bolsheviks in Russia and our party, the Socialist Party of America, refused to endorse the idea that let's support the capitalists in our own country in the war. So we were on the right side of history then. Unfortunately, Lenin was in exile. He was in no position to exercise much actual control over the international. And, of course, the Socialist Party over here was marginal to war in Europe at that time. And our influence was not that great. That's another way it could have gone differently. Now, having said that, and having going through the tragedy of World War One, it is pretty questionable, and I think most historians would agree, that the Russian Revolution would have taken place in the absence of World War One, because things got so bad in Russia with World War One, with the troops insufficiently clothed and fed and armed troops of the Tsar, with the collapse of the domestic economy, with a ruling class that was totally out of touch. This is starting to sound familiar, I'm sure. And that was a time when, people said, look, we can't take this system anymore. We got to change this system, and we have to have a system. We have to have a state. that represents us and our needs and our requirements, and not a small ruling class and capitalist class. Now, in 1905, there was almost a revolution in Russia, but there was no war at that time of any sufficient magnitude, although I do believe you had some conflict between Russia and Japan. But, I mean, there was no world war to really push it in that direction. And there were mass strikes, and there was quite a bit of insurrection at that time, but it was put down. And Trotsky, go ahead. I'm saying that, you know, crisis also brings opportunity. So although, you know, we should try to stop it, we definitely should try to stop war any way we can.
Yeah, but unfortunately, what we see many times in a capitalist society, the crisis is created by the capitalists, and the opportunity is created for the capitalists as well. We can see what happened after 9/11. We say the world was saying, and the U.S. was saying, oh, we have a crisis. We have terrorists. They're attacking this country. And then after the dust started settling, next thing we knew is we had another government. I mean, where was the opportunity? The opportunity wasn't for working people like you and me and the people listening to this program. We had another government that we don't even recognize today. Would you call that an opportunity? No, I wouldn't call that an opportunity.
No, well, I mean,
Stephen, I know you're not seeing that's the opportunity, but I mean, the opportunity, you can look at it two ways: is it for working people, or is for the ones that actually create the crisis? Because we can see in capitalist societies, crises are created on a daily and a weekly basis, so that they can control the direction of the economy, control the direction of society. And we're going to get a little bit more to that.
Yeah, I mean, look, these crises, and you're quite right about that, the capitalist ruling class, the financial, corporate, military, industrial complex, the international banking systems, and so on and so forth, they have a lot to at stake, and they certainly have a lot of power in their hands, and they will try to use the situation to their own advantage. I mean, it's a tremendous struggle, but the potential power in the masses of people is there, and the problem is consciousness and the will to act. Those are two very important things. I think I mentioned at some prior show that I'm very much in favor of what Rosa Luxemburg, who is a Marxist theorist in Poland and Germany from the early part of the 20th century into World War One, I'm very much in favor of the mass strike. And not one that is controlled by union hierarchy, but one which spreads spontaneously among the masses of people, because it's only the labor energy of working people that keeps the society running. It isn't the politicians sitting around on their fat asses in the House of Representatives and in the Senate with all their benefits and pensions and everything else, cutting off unemployment insurance to people who are barely surviving now. No, they're not the ones that really have the power. It's in the masses of people, because if the trucks stop running and the food and the clothing stop being delivered and, the people in the offices stopped pushing the papers around and doing what they had to do to keep the economy and the communications among the different areas of the economy going, if that happened, the society would come to a complete and utter standstill within several weeks. At that time, the masses of people could create a socialist state.
But it
doesn't take anything else, because all of these guys on Wall Street and these investors and their servants in Washington and so on and so forth, they don't drive the trucks. They don't create the food. They're not, you know, bringing in the clothing. They're not doing any of this stuff.
But let's face it, Steve, they're hooked up with the, and representing the people that, you know, sign the paychecks, you know?
Right.
And as long as they have their, you know, making certain they sign that check that's paying $8 an hour or $10 an hour, people say, well,
right,
at least I have a job. You know,
well,
you're starving.
Yeah,
you live in
the poverty.
Yeah, but what they're doing is, you know, is still making certain that the masses do not revolt against the madness that's taking place in society. In other words, as long as they're fed and they're able to keep a roof over their head, you know, they won't revolt. And this
is what
we have seen is taking place in, you know, societies across the world, not just with the U.S. But Stephen, you know, what I want to do is I want to get a little bit, because we're going to look at the, because as I mentioned, we're in the more advanced stages of imperialism, and we can see what is taking place in the U.S. as this, what is happening here is not new to the world. I mean, we can see that it's been empire building, not only within this century, but we have seen it with the, over the last five centuries. We have seen it for thousands of years. We saw this with the Greeks and the Romans and the Carthaginians. We saw it with the Persians. We have seen it with the British. We have seen it with the French. We have seen it through millennium where empire building and as far as for conquest. But what this is always being done for, it is not being done from the behest of the leaders of those countries, but it's the ones that are really ruling the financial institutions, the banks that are in control. Now, when we look at empire building, as I mentioned, much of what we saw taking place here in this country right after the Revolutionary War, it was an agrarian society, and then it started moving into an industrial society in the late 1700s and into the 1800s. Much of what we saw in the Civil War was a result of the advancements in the Industrial Revolution in the 1800s. This country started moving beyond its own shores as far as the resources that were needed to satisfy the appetite for the super rich in the late 1800s, as the Industrial Revolution started to grow. They were already looking forward to having the U.S. to get involved in World War One back in before the war. We entered toward the end of the war, but the industrialists were already contemplating us getting involved in the war before the American public even knew about that. But when we look at empire building, the U.S. is involved in the same process that we have seen within recent centuries, as I mentioned, with the British. We saw the same thing with the French. We see the same thing with the U.S. Now, when I speak of building the empire, let's bring it on relevant terms that people can understand today, because we have a situation that is happening in South Sudan. The only reason why we are involved, they say, to protect American interests, we are involved in Sudan because of the oil. If the oil was not there, we would not be there.
Exactly.
We looked at Afghanistan. We said that they were harboring and training terrorists. There was no evidence that that was taking place. But we invaded that country more than a decade ago, and then shortly after that, we invaded Iraq. Supposedly, it was on a lie. This is building the empire. Stephen, we have the same thing that very interesting in the last program that we covered with Alan Mackey. We were talking about, I mentioned about the Libya's Transitional National Council. This was shortly after the invasion of First of all, the UN did not give NATO and the U.S. the right to invade that country. But the U.S. was looking at, supposedly, to protect American interests that they started to give support to the opposition. And
yeah.
and doing that, what they did is they supported Libya's Transitional National Council. And before the uprising was even complete, they had already formed a government within a government and started funneling money into that country through this illegitimate government that was created. But,
right.
Stephen, we have seen this one country after another, not just with Libya, not with just Egypt, not with Syria, and Syria is a good example. Just recently, we were saying protecting for human rights, and we had no evidence that those illegal chemical weapons was even done by that government. But the U.S. was on the verge of going into another war to build the empire and protecting the interests of the super rich that they represent. But,
right.
Stephen, this has been one example after another, not looking at other governments, but looking at this country, looking at the U.S., and we have a deplorable record when it comes to protecting human rights. When it comes to human rights, we are the king of shooting drones into countries. You've probably
right.
seen just recently about the wedding party that was broken up. Obama decided to send a drone in to destroy a whole wedding party. But the point that I'm making, Stephen, and I just want you to give your comments on this.
Yeah.
When you talk about empire building, it starts with the greed of the capitalists to be able to supply and build their industries, looking for cheap labor, and also to go and capture the resources of other countries. And people,
yeah.
our listeners, need to understand how this works and how the capitalist works and how we get involved in their dirty wars.
Correct. Well, I mean, as you said, you know, it's this wars for resources, wars for cheap labor, and, of course, the preferred way would be economic pressures and so on and so forth, but, you know, they're contending imperialist countries, and that's what brought on World War I and World War II. And that's what the history is. And all of this stuff about democracy, you know, is a bunch of baloney. They have no concern about democracy. They don't have concern about it domestically. You know, so why would they have any concern about it in any other country? It's just a cover. You know, it's a cover-up. That's all.
Now I want to ask you,
how is the war
on drugs, how is that a cover-up? Because, you know, this war on drugs is just a big farce in this country. How is that a cover-up?
Well, there's a big, as you know, there's a big prison industrial complex, and it's increasingly being privatized, and they need customers, and I use the word customer advisedly, they need inmates. And, and so the United States has more people in prison than any other country in the entire world.
Exactly.
And that's an industry, because you open up a prison, it gets privatized so that some corporation makes a profit out of it. They use the convicts' labor for slave labor, so they only have to pay them, you know, a few bucks a day to work, to do whatever it is they're doing. And, in fact, some prisons subcontract out with local capitalists. And the prisoners produce their products, and of course, you know, brings jobs as prison guards and as commissary workers and so on and so forth. So
now, one of the other things I see, Stephen, is we see how the U.S. uses this as a pseudo means of by which they can go and invade other countries, set up puppet governments.
Right.
Supposedly to control the drugs in those countries, but basically the U.S. is in cahoots with those governments. And one of the things that we saw with this Oliver North thing that they had to bring to a quick close, and this was during the Reagan administration, whereas Oliver North said, well, you know, I'm ready to ready to talk. I'm ready to talk about, you know, how we using drug money to, you know, set up U.S. Military actions in countries. But
right. But
we can see that this war on drugs, Stephen, you know, this is another way that they use to, you know, launder money as far as for more occupation, to be able to supply, you know, to supply many of the illegal activities that we are doing in many of these countries. We can see that drug money, people need to understand drug money is already being funneled throughout Afghanistan. The U.S. is allowing the drug trade to proliferate in Afghanistan. They are producing more drugs since we have been there than they were under the Taliban.
That's the main domestic industry and their main domestic source of income. Yeah, there's no question about it.
I'm going to make a brief announcement. I want you to just mention about this war on terror, how the capitalists and how the in an imperialist society, how the war on terror is used as a farce where they can invade countries. But I just want to mention very briefly, we have Stephen Katz. He's joining us once again. He's with the Socialist Party USA. Stephen Katz, he is one of the regulars that appear on our show from time to time with a lot of useful information that we can understand how capitalism works and how socialism provides many opportunities and the answers that working people need today. Stephen, thanks again for joining the program.
It's always a pleasure.
Stephen, but I want you to talk about this after 9/11, you know, in retrospect, it was that shock and awe. It stopped everyone in their tracks. It's something that we weren't expecting. But since the war on terror began as a result of that, it really has turned out to be a war on working people. We have lost our rights and our freedoms, and now we can see that the world is going in a completely different direction from what we thought. It's still going in the same direction, but it's going in a different direction where, first of all, they're still utilizing slave labor, which we basically work for slave labor today. But in addition to that, the only thing it brought in addition to that is that we have lost our freedoms as well.
Yes.
And then 2008 was the point where they decided, let's let the economy collapse for working people. And then since 2008, where it was a financial collapse, but the war on terror has still continued against working people, where our labor has even cheapened since that time. But how is this war on terror? What should working people understand about this, you know, war on terror?
Working people need to understand that the war on terror is really a war on working people. That's not to say that there aren't terrorists in the world.
Right.
The whole issue of terrorism is being used by the capitalists to terrorize their own population into submission and to further subject people to more intense exploitation and repression. And, the cheapening of labor, the increase in unemployment, which is still extremely bad, much worse than the official figures hold to it, and the idea is, and you can, and there is no redress for it in the legal system, because if the President of the United States designates a person or organization, either domestically and internationally, a terrorist, it now becomes a national security issue. If anyone wants to go to court and challenge that, good luck, because as soon as the judge hears national security, that's the end of the case.
Right, in the story.
Yeah. Most of the judges will say, well, national security, I can't hear it. You know, I mean, I can't get the information, and there's, I just have to accept the the government's word for it. And now, as far as these unconstitutional wiretaps, we did have one judge recently here in New York, a federal judge who held finally, no, it wasn't here in New York. I think it was down in Virginia, held that, you know, it was unconstitutional.
The wiretaps were
Fourth Amendment.
Unconstitutional. Right.
Yeah, to collect all this stuff. And now we had a judge up here. That
and
came
a judge in New York.
Conclusion. They came to, I mean, eventually it's going to go to the Supreme Court, but the whole thing is, all they have to do, it's like magic words, you know, all they have to do is say national security, and suddenly people have no right to anything. They have no right to due process. They have no right to a lawyer. They have no right to a speedy trial. They have no rights. And the fact
but,
that there
but
is
that legal? You're an attorney. No, is that legal?
No, of course it isn't legal, but you have to be able to challenge it and get it overturned. Now, there are people who are trying to do that, but it's, you know, the deck is stacked against them because of these national security precedents. And, you know, we'll have to see what happens, and I am not too encouraged by it, but the more people protest about it and bring it out, you know, the better the chance is to get the process stopped. Now, they're trying to contain it by saying, putting out reports and stating that, you know, they collect all these numbers from everybody and all these things, phone numbers and whatever, and they won't, they'll get a warrant if necessary, you know, if, let's say, somebody from outside the country from a known terrorist location calls an American, someone in the country here, they have to get a warrant to be able to go in and wiretap the person here in the United States, you know, and so on and so on, still claiming that that's...
But Stephen, how in the world can any judge say it's legal for a nation to spy on its own citizens? We were criticizing the Germans for this. How in the world can we say that it's legal because of terrorists to spy on our own people?
Well, I mean, look, judges, you know, are human beings, and they have their own particular take on, you know, the facts and the law. And, I mean, I can tell you, I've tried many cases here in New York City, of course not, you know, on this particular topic. And, you know, I can come into court with almost the exact same facts, and I can get exactly different results depending on who I had that day as a judge. So,
now,
you know,
The one thing I wanted to bring up is because when we could see the advanced stages of imperialism, and, you know, one of the beginning stages is building an empire, and then we can see that's part of the stages of imperialism. But now we get to advanced stages, and then you go into wars, which we have been in wars, and then you get into the point where we are also one of the areas of advanced imperialism, which is world domination. That was very clear from the Germans. In other words, you know, it was one conquest after another. You had Neville Chamberlain was saying, you know, we have peace in our times, and the Germans were saying, we're not finished yet. But we see the same thing that is happening now as far as for world domination. And what part of world domination is you want to have control on everyone in society. Again, I can use the Germans as an example of that. I could use the old Soviet, the USSR as an example of that. I can use China as an example of that. You still have that in China, but it's worse. No nation has come to the level of that type of being so invasive in people's private lives as we see with this country today, never before. And what the NSA is doing, we have never seen it taken to that level before. But this is part of moving into that advanced stage of imperialism that we see today. Am I correct?
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, and the increasing surveillance of the entire citizenry, has gone in tandem with the deterioration of the economy, and also with the increasingly powerful other imperialist forces in the world that are contending for markets and so on and so forth. Interestingly enough, on all of this surveillance of foreign leaders, remember it came out in the papers a couple of weeks ago that they had a wiretap on the president of Brazil.
Right, exactly.
And
also Merkel.
Brazil,
right.
Yeah, Brazil. But they didn't say anything else about the situation. Now, today, lo and behold, I'm reading in the newspaper that the president of Brazil is trying to do something for the masses of people there and has increasingly close relationship with Cuba and has a deal with the Cuban government because there is virtually no medical care in many of the poor areas of various parts of Brazil. And the Cubans, who have one of the best medical systems in the world under socialism, have been sending them hundreds and hundreds of doctors to go into the ghettos and barrios there to provide medical care for people. And, in exchange, there's increasing trade and so on and so forth. So I'm sure that the wiretapping of the president of Brazil had everything to do with that. You know, just on that one case.
Right.
But, of course, it's not put in context. I mean, weeks after we find out about it, we have this bit of information, and the wiretapping of other leaders of other countries similarly must have other particular reasons. Now, the president of Brazil, as far as I know, could not be defined as a terrorist by any manner, shape, or form. It's got absolutely nothing to do with terrorism. It has to do with the capitalist interests in various parts of the world, and they have an eye peeled out, particularly since Hugo Chavez was successful in Venezuela, and since the Cuban Revolution has survived despite all the vicissitudes of that they have had to undergo, and of course I'm not saying there were no problems there. But at the same time, they keep an eye on these situations, and they're looking for every way to overthrow these governments and to get rid of it so that,
also overthrow the leadership of those countries as well.
Yes, of course, overthrow the leadership and get people in, like in Honduras. They had a leader that was trying to steer the Honduras in the direction of helping the masses of people. And they got rid of him. Now there was another election down there, no doubt manipulated by American intelligence agencies and American influence and economic pressures, and, to try to keep out anybody that might change the situation of profitable investment in Honduras. Any leader, any state that is trying to look out after the interests of the masses of people automatically becomes an enemy of the American capitalist state. Automatically.
Oh, you're right.
Automatically. Because that means it cuts into their profits. That means better working conditions for the people, higher wages, and so on and so on. They don't want that, And it's not just the United States. You could include, capitalists all over the world in its various phases. But focusing here, which we're most familiar with, the operation here, and that's what it's all about. It has absolutely nothing to do with terrorism. Zero.
Zero.
Zero. It's just another excuse.
Once again, I just want to mention that we have Stephen Katz. He's joining our program today. Stephen Katz is with the Socialist Party USA. He comes on our program every other week as a frequent guest, sharing a lot of useful information where working people can understand how capitalism, how it functions, and also how what socialism has to offer, how it is a way that works for working people. And Stephen, thanks again for joining the program.
You're welcome.
Stephen, we have just a few more minutes, a little over 10 minutes, and I want you to give some contact information. But as I mentioned, our program today is it too late for socialism to save America? But, Stephen, in this last few minutes, I just want you to give some projections for 2014 and 16. As I mentioned in information I put out, has the damage been done, and can the next president make a difference? We can see that this president hasn't made any difference. The only thing is he has made things twice as bad as was before his predecessor. People had a lot of hopes and dreams of what they thought that this president was going to do for minorities, what he was going to do for human rights. He said within his first 9 months in office he was going to end this war. He went back on that promise. Within the first year in office, he not only broke the promise, but he expanded the war. He has sent more drones into other countries than ever before under any U.S. president. Let's look forward, and when we say for 2000, going into 2014 and 16, Stephen, let me just be right up front. I don't see any leadership on the left. I mean, I don't see any leadership as far as in the political arena. I see a lot of leadership out there, but no one that is stepping forward as far as to be a voice for the working people. Because in any society, many times I've spoke to many hundreds and hundreds of people that are leaders, but a lot of it comes down to we don't need a leader. We will stand as a people. But for every movement, you do need leadership, and I don't see it out there, Stephen. What do you see?
Well, I mean, in the way you posed your question, you answered your question in to a certain extent.
Well, I'm talking about within our own party. I mean, we have elections coming up. We have within the next 3 years. I mean, the Democrats and Republicans are already throwing out people out there for 2016. We're not even talking about anything in our party or any of the other socialist parties, or for that matter, even the communist parties. I don't see us with many of the issues that we are facing today. We don't have anyone that can be a voice of the collective working class or the labor movement.
Well, I think that's true, and I think Obama is a textbook example of why, any candidate from either the Democratic or Republican Party is just going to continue in some form or another the same policies that are not beneficial to the masses of people living here and living in other parts of the world. And, in a way, as far as leadership is concerned, the best thing, of course, would be a united front, of various different factions on the left and various different parties. Now, I know the Communist Party USA has been supporting progressive Democrats for many decades, and I don't see any change in their course, although after Obama, one would think they might reappraise their approach, but one doesn't know. And that's why I put my hopes more in the spontaneous movement of masses of people than I do in any type of political leadership coming out of any kind of party that's on the horizon here today. Now, that's not to say, I mean, you just had a socialist elected to the Seattle City Council, and it's certainly useful to try to get socialists elected to act as tribunes of the people. But the system is so dominated by big money, by the corporate control and by lobbyists and so on and so forth. It's so controlled and owned by them.
Right. And that's a good point, because you have to realize the system is controlled by big money and by the lobbyists. That these elections, you have to realize that they are controlling the media. They are controlling the monies that are going to the campaigns.
Right,
they're controlling
right.
the politicians that are voting for various campaign reforms or whatever.
So when you look at a given election, especially during a presidential election, there's billions of dollars that is being spent, not only just for the campaign, but the apparatus that's in place to make certain that they get their candidates out there and elect and make certain that the ones that they have out. And of course, we know it's a dog and pony show because, you know, they already know who the next leader is, who the next person that they will have installed as president. And of course, we could see this all the way from the period around the same time when Nixon, when he was running against Nixon was running against Ronald Reagan. So I mean, we can see that the control of powers and the leadership is in the hands of the wealthy few in our society. But I just want to touch a little bit on, you know, we have some big issues out there. And I believe one of the good sources of being able, without leadership, one of the good sources of getting information and building a movement starts with organizations such as the organization that you're with and that I'm with, is the Socialist Party USA. Because people, and I believe that there's been a surge and growth within recent, since this last election, there has been a lot of growth within the party. Am I correct?
Yes, we are growing, and every day there are more and more people joining, and there's this great hope in that. I think in the immediate future, one of our priorities has to be continued recruitment, but also education, so that people can learn what socialism really is and what it can really do. Now, as far as the electoral system is concerned, I mean, the party has pledged, I believe, to run in 10 electoral races in the next 2 years. And I don't know any more specifics on that. The best chances, of course, are on the most local offices. But the, my way of thinking, education in socialist consciousness and history and theory and practice is the most important priority. And, you know, the masses of people, you know, as the situation changes, will more and more be able to mobilize themselves and create a society which is a truly human society, fulfilling human needs and not turning people into commodities and not having this inhuman system that we have to live under. And, you know, reading the history of the Russian Revolution, and I can recommend two books, one by a member of our own party, John Reed, who wrote 10 Days That Shook the World, which is an excellent portrayal of the Bolshevik Revolution and the Russian Revolution, because it was comprised of, it was carried by the masses of people there. It was not, as they teach in a lot of the American schools, it was not a coup by the Bolshevik parties running by run by Lenin. Lenin did provide leadership, but it was the masses of people that carried it because the Bolsheviks had the clearest plan and the plan that appealed to most of the people, but it was the people themselves that overthrew the Tsarist state and instituted a social state. So, I mean, if you get, you know, the task really is education and mobilization. And then, you know, when we get into a period of severe crisis, which one way or another it looks like we're heading to, then masses of people can begin to mobilize themselves and move against the system. And then you will see the system beginning to crack. There'll be openings and there'll be a way to restructure it and a way to make the society serve the interests of the people and not the small ruling elite. And
what are your opinions about Bernie Sanders? Because he's saying that no one step up to represent the left and working people, that he's willing to step up and fill in that void. But I don't even know if he's really the right person to represent the left or be a voice for the left, considering that in many cases he's actually backed some of these ridiculous policies of the Obama administration.
I'm a little bit...
What is your opinion about Bernie Sanders?
Well, Bernie Sanders, I mean, he talks a good game, and, you know, his policies are preferable to Most of the social policies he pushes are preferable to 99% of his colleagues. But you have to understand he plays political games of his own. He represents, you know, a state, and he very much depends on the Democratic Party to bring the bacon home back to Vermont and
right.
you know, for programs and resources and so on. So if he does something to damage their presidential prospects, they're
no
not
more
gonna
bacon.
Forget that. No, I
right.
mean, well, they're not going to, and it's not like Ralph Nader, because Ralph Nader was an outsider, so there was really very little they could do to Ralph Nader
right.
because he's an independent citizen, so, I mean, he didn't need them for anything. But it could be, this could be a ploy on Bernie's part to try to pressure the party, you know, more left, make it more combative. You know, Dennis Kucinich yeah. within the Democratic Party tried the same thing. And he wanted to run against Obama in the primaries in the last election, and he just suddenly disappeared. He had a talk with Obama, and I don't know what they told him, and I don't know what they promised him. I mean,
what would you have to say to the left and to working people, to anyone thinking that they should vote for Hillary Clinton just because she's a female? What would you have to say to the left regarding that? And then
I would
give
Hillary,
some context
Hillary
information.
Hillary Clinton, in no manner, shape, or form, represents our interests.
Exactly.
No,
she's worse than Obama.
She does not represent our interests.
Exactly, because we were fooled before with Obama, because here's the first black, and now here's the first woman, you know. But people, you should not be fooled again. Again, Stephen, I want to thank you for joining the program. I want you to
thank
give
you.
Contact information how people can reach you. We really enjoy having you come on every time with everything that you have to offer.
I can be reached at the national headquarters of the Socialist Party USA at 339 Lafayette Street, New York, New York. And, you know, if you Google Socialist Party USA, you know, you'll see are our activities, all the branches throughout the United States, wherever you happen to be located. You know, there's a good chance that there's a branch in your state. And anybody who wants to correspond with me can send a letter there. You know, care of the Socialist Party. I believe the room is 303. And 303. And you know, I certainly would be more than happy to answer that. And also go check out our website. You can join the party. You can read our constitution. You could read our political platform. And our we have people throughout the United States joining from every state. We have chapters now in Alabama. We have chapters in California, Illinois, Vermont, you know, all over the United States. And, you know, our party has probably the oldest socialist party in the United States. We've been a factor in the history of the United States, including in the battle against World War One. And, you know, we've been around for a century now, and
right.
We're going to be around for another century. And
well,
we're going to keep fighting.
Alan, Stephen, I want to thank
yeah.
you once again for joining the program. I look forward to having you back on a future broadcast. Thanks again. And again,
thank
I'd like to
Stuart.
Thank our listeners for joining the program. I always like to thank Ruth Ann for sponsoring this program.
Thank you, Ruth.
And thanks again for joining the Socialist Insight. We'll see you again next week at the same time.
Thank you.
Have a good
thank
night,
you.
Everyone.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, everyone. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Good night.